Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Pevi and I will be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome and thank you for joining us. The purpose of these calls is really to share stories and to tell stories, stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our special guest speaker is none other than Niti Desai, and someone who embodies today's theme of dancing, design, and the journey from the form to the formless. Thanks again for joining today's call. Let's start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves. Thank you. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call today in conversation with Niti Desai. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Trusha Mehta, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into a more informal Q&A and circle of sharing, where we'll invite questions and reflections. The queue is open right now, so at any point, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicebase.org. I'd like to introduce our wonderful moderator today, Trusha Mehta, a longtime friend and volunteer with Service Base. Trusha is a founding member of Karma Kitchen in Berkeley, and when we started now almost a decade ago, she was in charge of the interior design and ambiance, and so many of the ideas and little touches that she brought in way back at the beginning have really stood the test of time and continue to add beauty, heart, and spirit to that generous space. Trusha herself has a natural eye for design, a passion for dance, and a connection to Indian classical dance in particular. So Niti's journey is one that strikes a deep chord for her. I will now hand over to Trusha. Trusha, take it away.
Hi, everyone. I would love to introduce Niti Desai. And as Bhavi mentioned, this particular Awaken Call is really close to my heart because I have a deep connection and joy with dance and design in my own journey, and a lot of what I see reflected here in Niti's journey is just so inspiring to me. So before we get into, I'd love to introduce Niti. Niti is a designer, a professional dancer, educator, and seeker of truth. Her journey began with graphic design and eventually led her to explore inner design through the classical Indian dance form of Mohiniyattam. She sees dance as a way of life and a tool to reach transcendence. This journey of dance has transformed her life and ignited a passion for educating others about the rich stories and offerings of classical Indian art, Ayurveda, and a general holistic approach to living. She is deeply engaged at the Shakti Yoga Ashram, where she is also the executive trustee under the mentorship of her teacher, Mandakini Trivedi. Design continues to be a part of her life, as she is also the founder and creative head of Niti Design Lab in Bangalore. So I'd like to welcome Niti today.
Hi, Trusha. Thank you so much for the introduction.
Yes, so glad to have you.
Yes, it's really wonderful and actually a privilege and honor to be a part of the Awakening Call. So yes, I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, I am too. There's so many questions that I have, but I just wanted to start by saying that your journey was so inspiring to read about, and such a different merging of two separate fields, as such as dance and design. Maybe we can start out just learning a little bit more about how you understand and experience this relationship between dance and design. I know in the Awaken theme, we talked about going from the form to the formless.
Yes. So actually, my relationship with design and dance is it's very interconnected. They are interrelated. They are like two sides of the coin, and almost two different dimensions through which I express myself. And in some sense, I don't really see a differentiation between the two, because they are forms and tools to communicate, forms and tools to express and engage. And they both actually just happened to be. There was no plan, there was no strategy of choosing these two and, you know, working around it. It's just, mm-hmm. It was a flow that one came into my life and one led to the other, and they are just two aspects of who I am now.
Okay. Yeah, I understand that. And how, I guess at an early age, did you had taken dance at a younger age, and then you explored design in school. How did those two, how did you have the idea to say, okay, there's this inner form, inner expression that I need to bring forth in my life, and that I needed something more than just this design and commercial aspect?
Oh, well, actually, as a little girl, I did train in classical Indian dance, just as any little girl in India. Everyone's put into dance classes, like hobby mm-hmm. classes, evening classes, and I was doing Bharatanatyam, another dance form from Tamil Nadu in India. And though initially I was very really resisting the engagement with the classical arts, but my mother was really keen that I would pursue it. So with great difficulty, I would say that, you know, I kind of stuck to it. And it was a hobby, and I was not really deep or engaged or really involved in it, but I kind of just went through it more because of my mother's persistence that I should be continuing. And at some point, I almost left it also, because when I went into college with, you know, college work and studies, and right. My undergraduate was in applied art, which is commercial art and commercial design. And mm-hmm. I finished my undergraduate, and by the time I finished my undergraduate, I had stopped dancing, means taking classes, though I did my initial arangetram and performance as a part of my journey in Bharatanatyam. But I would say I was not really learning it. I don't know what I was doing, but I just went through it. And after I graduated and finished my undergraduate, I just, as one would do, I just instinctively took up a job in a design firm then, a very well-known design firm at that point. And it was my first job and my first day at work. And I went into work and I had a very terrible feeling in my tummy. I just felt extremely uncomfortable, and one or two, three days passed, and I just was actually in deep pain and trauma, and I just felt that I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. And the one thing that struck me at that point is that I was getting a so-called salary for the work that I was doing for the company. Mm-hmm. The company was getting money from a client for what we were creating for them, and eventually the client was taking what was created by us in the company and selling their product or promoting themselves and making money in the end. So I just felt that the whole transaction is financial through and through, and I can't be doing this for the rest of my life. And I did not know what I could do, and I, at that point I was howling and crying, and I just felt this deep urge that, you know, this is not it, but I did not have any answers. And so I just left the job very quickly. I don't even know if I really finished a month, maybe not. I don't have memory of it anymore. And I left the job, and the only logical thing at that time occurred to me is maybe I should go abroad for further studies. And I applied to a few universities, and I went to a really lovely design school in Atlanta, Georgia, called Portfolio Center. And I was very fortunate that I found that school, and I went there. But as soon as I got to the USA, and the first day, the second day of my new course and a new school and a new country, I felt that everything that I'm going to create over here is outside me, so in the form of books or brochures or installations, and nothing is going to be internalized. And I said, this is not it. I don't feel I want to do that. I want to engage with holistic design. And that's a term that just came to me. I did not know what it meant, and it has actually taken me quite many years to really define for myself what I really understand when I say holistic design. And I just said that I want to engage with design holistically. I want to engage with body design, and I want to design and create with my body and not outside my body. And how do I do it? And right. So I went to my dean. He's a very, very dear mentor. And I went to him at that point, and I said that, I need to leave. And I had come to a new country for a new course, which is a two-year program. And I said, I'm going to leave because I don't want to engage with design at an outward level. I want to engage with internal body design. And I think I just need to dance. And that was something that just came to me. It was not something I'd read. It just came, and we had really long conversations, and he understood what I was pointing towards. And he told me, just stick on to the 2 years, and you can do non-commercial projects and engage with design in a different way, and then you go and dance. And somewhere I really connected with him as a mentor, and so I stuck on for the 2 years. But the moment I graduated, I was itching to go back and train and dance. And it was a very normal thought that I will train in classical Indian dance just because I had done it. And so then after my graduation, I moved back to India. And that's how I really came back to dance. So it was basically design that got me back into dance, an engagement with internal body design. Yeah,
I'm curious. While you're talking about this journey, this sounds so amazing, and it was so uncertain at the time. What type of like principles or lessons or values that you had up to that point really allowed you to walk in that path of uncertainty and lead you to this design and idea and your greater truth and this idea of dance as transcendence? Because I feel like maybe, your roots or your family, or there has to be like some sort of foundation, I feel, that allows you to take that leap of faith, I guess.
When I was still studying in the USA and doing my 2 years in design, I think it was just more than anything an inner intensity, I would say. And the urge was so strong that I held on to it even for the 2 years, because somewhere on the line, maybe my dean felt, or maybe my parents felt that, it will pass by the time she graduates. But it was a very, very deep-rooted urge, I feel. And I just held on to it, because the moment I graduated, I had my portfolio, and my dean wanted me to go and meet designers all over in New York. And I told him that, Hank, I need to go back to India. He said, give me 1 week. And I want you to meet a few designers. And actually, he set up meetings for me for one of all the top designers in the industry still now and at that point. And I was really, really fortunate that in 1 week, I had probably like 15 meetings in New York to show my work. Because somewhere he thought maybe I'll stick on or find design as an avenue to express myself. And I went through all the meetings and conversations, and it was very enriching and lovely. But at the end of it, I still knew that I had to go back to India. And so I started looking for a dance teacher at that point. And I told my mother, I just called her up and I said, do you know a dance teacher? Can you look for one for me? And she said, well, we'll have to look into it. And, obviously she was not very sure. And then through someone, she came to know of a lady very close to our house in India, in Bombay. And she said, she just told me over the phone that there is so-and-so lady, and this is where she stays, and she teaches. So I said, can you please get me her contact details? And I wrote her a letter, and I sent it with my mother, and the mother went and gave it to her. And my teacher just read it and said that, I can teach anyone who comes to me. So if she wants to learn, she has to come and train. And my mother just told me that over the phone, and it was in a matter of, I think, 6 days that I packed my bags and I was back in India at home. And I had just received my work permit, and at that point I remember that work permits were very precious for the students. And I had received my work permit at the doorstep when I was leaving for the airport. And I was with my uncle, my family at that point in Boston, and they said that, are you sure you really want to go? You've just got your work permit. And we were on our way to the airport, and I said, no, I think I'm going to go. And so I would just say that it was just a very innate urge and an intensity, which it was not something that I was forcing on or working on. It just happened. I don't even know that what made me hold on.
Right. It sounded like you were very in touch with your inner voice and inner calling, and you were just trying to be really true to yourself in that moment.
And I was not analyzing either of this, you know, Krishna. I know it was just that something that I have to do it. I have to do it, you know. It wasn't that I was logically thinking that is it my inner voice or not. I didn't right. have that vocabulary at that point. I was 22 years old, and I was not exposed to a larger picture of life at all at that point. Mm-hmm. And so I did not have the wherewithal to even assess what I was feeling and what I was doing. It was just, as I said, the feeling held itself on. I did not.
Right.
And that's how I came back to India in a week, and saying that now I will dance.
So to go into a little bit more about the dance, then actually, can you tell us a little bit about your teacher and the dance, the classical dance form of Mohiniyattam?
Yes, of course. So it's really interesting also, in Mohiniyattam is a dance form that comes from southern India, from Kerala, and it is a very, very beautiful dance form which has swinging, swaying, circling, serpentine and elephantine movements. And these movements are really inspired from the nature that it comes from the swaying palm trees, the undulating waters over there. And it is a very, I would say, the style has a slower pace than the other classical Indian forms. And somewhere it is more internal and more, it's like circular in its form. And it has a very rich mimetic tradition also. Though I had no idea about these aspects, the beautiful aspects of Mohiniyattam at that point, I thought I was coming back to India to train in Bharatanatyam, and then the teacher that I had picked, I thought she was a Bharatanatyam teacher. I had no idea she was a Mohiniyattam teacher. And I came back to India and I called her, and she said that, yes, you can come and meet me after a week at this so-and-so ashram. Though she lived like 5 minutes from my house, in Bombay, but she also runs an ashram that is 3 hours from Bombay. So she called me to the ashram because they were having a dance retreat at that point over there. And she said, why don't you just come there first and then we'll talk. And so I went to the retreat over there in the outskirts of Mumbai city. And I reached there, and in conversation, I realized that she was not a Bharatanatyam teacher. She was a Mohiniyattam teacher, and I did not know what Mohiniyattam was. And so I was like, I have come all the way from US, leaving a work permit to learn Bharatanatyam, and I reach here in the outskirts of Bombay, and she's actually not a Bharatanatyam teacher, she's a Mohiniyattam teacher. What do I do? And she told me that, yeah, if you want a Bharatanatyam teacher, then you should look for someone else. But somewhere I just connected with the essence that she was. And she did tell me in the conversation that, you know, styles are not important. The teacher is. Mm. And I think that was enough for me to process what it really meant in its true sense. And so I just said, whatever you teach, I will learn. And that's how I came to Mohiniyattam. So I did not choose Mohiniyattam, but I chose my teacher. And I am actually very blessed and fortunate, I would say, that I did not have to hunt for many teachers to find a teacher. You know, it was on a platter that this was the lady my mother came across, and I wrote to her and I came there and I just met her, you know. So I feel extremely blessed, and it was the formless energy that she had that I think attracted me. And now if I look back and try and understand that when I say that when the Shastras, when the Indian traditional texts say that, you know, from the formless comes the form, and the form is meant to take you back to the formless. I think that really fits into the journey, that it was the formless energy that she had that held me on, through which I learned this form, and I'm still practicing the form. And somewhere this form is meant to take me back to that formless energy. So it kind of all just comes together. So yes, I have a deep connection with my teacher, and she has actually opened a whole worldview, not only of the classical Indian dance, but Indian arts, Indian philosophy, thought, holistic lifestyle, and just assimilated living, you know, with spirituality at the core. So that's, I received everything in one package through finding dance as a discipline that I wanted to engage with.
How has your teacher and the dance form, Mohini Atam, how has it really changed your day-to-day living or your daily practices, like outside of the deeper transformation? Has it changed just your general way of living and approaching the world on a day-to-day basis?
Oh, yes, completely. It actually just turned my life around, and it has in every way, from the point to the way one thinks, from the way one engages with people, from the way one is, from in the lifestyle, in eating, in sleeping, in praying, in even professional work. So everything changed because it's through this, like through this channel, I received a way of life, and it has given me, you know, it's almost given me a tool how to assess, engage, and live life. Mm-hmm. And it is the most precious gift, I think, that I have received, you know, from nature. That, so if I didn't have this facility, then I don't know, I would have been a different person. And I have completely changed as a person since what I was before I started training in dance. I just turned around completely. And there was a point where family and friends thought I was a different human being. So for a small interim period when the intense change was happening. But yeah, it turns one around completely in the way I think, in the way I sit. And I was very young, you know, I was 23 when I met her. So it was not that, you know, I was still finding my ground, you know. So yeah, right. Yeah. Right.
And how, so you had mentioned that it affected not only your way of living and interacting, but also has influenced your design. Can you talk a little bit more about how it has influenced your work and your design and your creativity?
Yes, definitely. So as a profession, like, you know, when you, as a human being, when one changes, when one understands a larger picture of life, when one understands and experiences that, you know, life is much more than, you know, a certain mundane existence, the way you'll approach work is also with a certain kind of detachment, and but with a lot of reverence to work in itself. So, you know, the quality in which one works, so in a way a project is delivered, you know. So what is, like, you need to work well. So that's something that I have, I think, got from this worldview also, that whatever it is, whatever the work is, you do it really well, whether it is a small letter that I'm writing or it is a big project that I'm designing, you do it well. You do it with not feeling that is the end of the world, because in a profession, things go up and down, you know, sometimes. You know, professionally, there is, like, you know, there is stress, there is, you know, work is not received well, sometimes you just don't meet timelines, but you don't, so it's not something that I don't let that control me. I do it with a lot of love, and I do it with a lot of intensity, and I like, and I do everything that I do, at least my aim is to try and do it as well as I can, but mm-hmm. if it doesn't happen, then there is a sense of understanding that this is not the goal of my life. You know, there is much more in life than this, you know, speaking. Yeah, so it's a sense of not feeling that you belong to anything, belong that I, like, the work doesn't control me. I do it well, and I let it be. yeah, I don't, yeah. So it's a sense of freedom, you know, that you have. And there's a lot of joy in working like that, you know, because you work well and you let it be and you let it go, you know. So that is one way in which my approach to work and also just design in itself, you know, I have understood a larger framework of design because, you know, design education in India emerges from the colonial formations, you know. So when we trained in graphic design in India, I did a five-year undergraduate program. There was nowhere that Indian aesthetics and Indian design have been talked about. And it's a pity that you don't learn that at all in design school. And then, of course, my latter part of my design education was in the USA. So obviously that was another aspect of design that I trained in. So I was completely unexposed to design in the Indian context, you know. So from the, in through the medium of dance and sculpture and painting and philosophy and aesthetics, the whole worldview of Indian design and Indian design aesthetics was revealed to me. So that really comes into my visual treatment, you know, because it's so integral to me because of the practice of the dance and the study of the Indian design framework. That really comes into my graphic design work somewhere. And just the understanding of holistic education, the understanding of aesthetics. So when I work with a certain kind of client, it really helps, you know. And I try to work with clients that I resonate more with than clients that are corporate in a certain sense. I don't work with them. So, yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow, that sounds amazing. So it sounds like the commercial aspects that you were initially a little apprehensive about, you feel more comfortable now that you have your roots grounded in something that you feel you're connecting with on a deeper level.
Yes, and now I feel that I can do all the commercial work also, and I do it, you know, as a part of Niti Design Lab, as a part of our work. We work with all kinds of clients as long as, you know, there is a certain integrity in what they are doing, and unless... So I am a little picky when it comes to the kind of clients that I work with, but as long as, you know, there is, as I said, integrity in what they do in their field, I would feel comfortable working with them. So yes, I do a lot of corporate work also. I work with a lot of art institutions. I work with a lot of artists. I work with in the education sector. So all kinds of design work.
Oh, wow. That sounds like you have a full plate there. So I was curious when you were talking about graphic design, I guess as somewhat of a dancer myself, and I wanted to learn a little bit more and understand a little bit more about what role the audience plays in not only just the classical dance, but in the form of design. Like, how does the audience fit into this process of transcendence, or do they? Like, how important is the audience to this process, I guess?
Well, if you talk from the terms of a classical Indian dance, the form in itself has been devised and designed by the tradition in a way that it gives energy. It gives energy not only to the practitioner, but it gives energy to the audience also, because of the theme, because of the music, because also the movement in the way the science in which it is designed. Mm-hmm. So the when an audience sees a classical dance performance or a classical music recital for that matter, they will feel a sense of integration, and so does the artist. And as much as the artist will feel it in purity, the audience will feel it in that much purity, you know, because it is a communication, it is a conversation that is happening. If I believe in what I'm doing and if I'm feeling it, you will feel it. So the audience is very important in the classical dance because it's a performing art and it is about a relationship between the practitioner and the audience. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you did. That was beautiful. That's what I was wondering, because I know so often when we talk about transcendence, in particular to dance, there's this inner journey that's happening and while you're performing. And I was just curious as to how, even is it necessary to have an audience there to still have that journey? Because, you know, dance itself creates that ladder,
yes,
as you mentioned.
Yeah, so that's not necessary to... Sorry.
No, go ahead.
So So it's not necessary to have, you can basically in your room, you can dance and you can perform and you can experience what the form has to give you. But it is like creation, you know, when you feel the need to create, you feel the need to express. And when you have a need to express, then that expression has to be shared.
Shared, right.
The sharing is the audience, you know. So audience is more someone with whom you share. It's like, you know, if you're a good cook, you can cook and you can eat and the food is delicious. But the moment you cook well and you've cooked, you want to share your food, you know. So it's more an innate human creative energy that's brings out, you know, and the same with the dance, that it's a form of sharing, it's a form of giving, you know.
So, right, and that's how a lot of the classical Indian arts are set up, to kind of follow that tradition, that pattern,
yes.
Which is why I feel like they're a really big part of the communities in India and have a feeling of unity, I guess.
Yes, so the arts really bind them, but it depends on the way one engages with it. You know, so it's very beautiful that the classical Indian dance or the classical Indian arts by itself has been devised and designed in a way that it facilitates an inward journey. It facilitates an inward journey because of the theme, the context, and also the aesthetic form of the dance. You know, somewhere when you sit, are in a dance posture, certain energy circuits in your body just connect, and that's why you feel more integrated. So in every way it facilitates an inner journey, but it is very important, and it is also up to the practitioner what is their intention behind it, with what integrity they engage with it, and with what intensity that they, you know, practice the art that would result in the penetrating of the form into one's life or into the so-called transcendence. Because, you know, transcendence as a word is you know, I don't even know, you know, whether one can use it or not, because it's, what do you really mean when one transcends, right? So it is more about somewhere at the beginning of an inner journey, but it all depends on the intention. Like, is dance a profession for me? Is dance a daily sadhana, a practice, a spiritual practice for me? How do I engage with it? How do I interact with it? What is my integrity? What is my intensity? It all depends on actually the ball is completely in the court of the practitioner. The form has it. But right. From practitioner to practitioner, it can change, you know. And I might not benefit at all what it has to give me, and I might benefit little or more.
And as you mentioned, part of that has to do with the teacher as well, and the philosophy and the relationship between the teacher and the student, because I know Indian classical dance has this very holistic and nurturing approach, that it's not just about the technique of dance, but it's the tradition and the philosophy and the arts and the history behind the dance form that actually transforms and allows for the opportunity for that journey of being interconnected to take place.
Yes. So yes, it's completely, it's an approach, and the approach comes from your teacher. And in my particular case, I have just been very fortunate that for my teacher, Mandakini ji, she basically has been studying, and that is her life's work, that what are the yogic traditions of classical Indian dance, and can this yoga of Indian dance come into and given to the dancer in a way that these principles not only are there in the form, but they somewhere enter the dancer's life. And the dance school, Nateshwari Dance Gurukul, that I have studied and I still study under Mandakini ji, basically is dedicated to reviving these yogic traditions of classical Indian dance and reviving the practice of it being a form that lends itself to transcendence. The form has it, but as practitioners, that tradition is almost lost. And she has, in her teaching training and her techniques, brought that back, which also requires a lot of awareness, which requires a certain penetration with and engagement with the form at a very spiritual level. So she feels that, you know, to be able to engage and practice and receive from these forms fully what it has to give you, you have to practice parallel spiritual practices. Otherwise, you will not understand what a Shiva stands for, because you are dancing the gods and goddesses. But there is a reason why you are dancing the gods and goddesses, because somewhere these gods and goddesses are symbols, and these symbols are actually, it's symbolic, but these symbols are actually principles, and you need to pierce through the form of a Shiva or a Ganpati into the symbolism, and going into understanding the formless essence and the principle that they stand for, and through the dance, and then that enters your life. And then that means you have received and you are benefiting from this form. And to be able to understand this philosophical context, a parallel spiritual practice or a discipline is very essential, is what she feels. And that's how she really trains us, that at every level you are being trained, not only in the practice of the form. So that's really the journey from the formless to the form, because there was a formless essence of what the dance is meant to touch upon, but to be able to work through that, the tradition designed this form with a philosophy, with an aesthetic, with beauty, with everything kind of clubbed into multiple layers. But the purpose of this, it is to go back into the formless energy of a higher level of consciousness or transcendence or absolute or whatever you want to call it. And so, but through the form, but somewhere as a practitioner, when you travel through the form, there is a lot of parallel study that is required to be able to really understand that and pierce from the form, pierce into the symbolism and go into the principle, and somewhere it coming back into your life. So the training is very, very important, and that's how the teacher doesn't teach you only the form, that is the dance, the steps or the dances. They've taught you a way of thinking, they've taught you Shiva, they've taught you Ganapati, they've taught you like multiple things, multi-layered engagement. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. I think being Indian myself and having studied these dance forms, I think it's beautiful to hear that there's a sense of making the not only the movement, but the stories behind the movement, the mythology, more relatable, and kind of breaking that down and bringing the significance into your life so that one is able to relate to what they are creating in the form of dance or movement. And I think that creates a deeper relationship with the dance, as you mentioned. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please tell me, sorry, yeah.
Going back to what you were saying about wanting to share and teach and educate, I know right now you're working with the Shakti Yoga Ashram. Can you tell me a little bit more about your journey there and how deeply engaged you are with the ashram?
Yes, sure. So Shakti Yoga Ashram is a space that was founded in 1995 by my teacher Mandakini Ji's spiritual master, Swami Sri Harish Madhukar. And he was, a very free Baba, lived in the Himalayas and was in Bombay, had a few students, and he had no structured institution or formula. He just taught spirituality as a way of life to his core disciples. And then at one fine day, he just felt that this education system all around is not the way our next generation and future generations need to be trained. There has to be some holistic understanding of life, of nature, of arts, of spirituality to be able to be a more fuller human being. So in the last year of his life, he set up this space, which is in the outskirts of Maharashtra, and Shakti Yoga Ashram, and he founded this, and Mandakini Ji has been with him since then, and she is the chairperson of that space. The space is basically, the vision of the space is that it is dedicated towards the study and practice of classical Indian arts, Indian sciences, Indian lifestyles, environment, ecology, with spirituality at the core. And if children can be taught in an environment like this, and if Gurukuls can engage in this environment, Gurukul of dance, music, architecture, sculpture, painting, and in midst of that, a school for children. Then this holistic engagement of education is what is really needed in today's time, you know, when everyone is in this outward rat race. You need to find somewhere your roots and then go universally out. So this is the vision of that space. The space has been there since 1995, Mandakini, under the chairmanship, chairpersonship of Mandakiniji. When I met her at the ashram. And since then, I have been in whichever way, just volunteering and working under her at the space, doing admin, doing creative work, cleaning of the bathrooms or whatever it is. I've been working for that place, and because the space has actually shaped me and my thoughts. And now I am a more structured form of the space. I am under the mentorship of Mandakiniji. I am the executive trustee of the space. So yes, we are working towards spreading this vision of holistic education and holistic lifestyle in with the assimilation of art, science, and environment. And in order to achieve that, we currently hold residential retreats, 3 days, 4 days, 2 days, depending on the groups who connect with us. And we initiate them into Indian culture, Indian thought, yoga, meditation, philosophy, Ayurveda, the importance of having a certain dinacharya, a certain schedule in your life with food and also nature treks and environment. An assimilation of all of that happens in our retreats at Shakti Yoga Ashram. Yes.
And is the retreat open to all ages or?
Yes, so we have children's programs every year. We have programs for college students. We also have them for adults and also for senior citizens. So it depends on what is the group that is coming, and a certain structure of a program will be curated as per them. But yes, it's open to all age groups. There are specific programs which are nature-centric, there are programs which are art-centric, there are programs which are spirituality-centric, and sometimes the programs are a simulation of all of them.
Oh, okay. So it's like the ability to kind of start this journey. You guys provide the environment and the space and allow people the path, basically.
Yes, so it's basically meant to begin the journey within and somewhere to find yourself, to find your roots, to understand your culture, understand who you are, understand holistic living. And then the idea is to go universally out. The ashram is basically a space for intense study, you know, of any kind. And as my teacher says that, you know, the ashram is actually inside you. And the ashrams outside facilitate as tools to gather you and give you the tools and the understanding and the courage that is required to begin an inner life. So that's when you come to an ashram. So even in our space, you come there to understand a holistic vision, to understand Indian thought, philosophy. And the essence of coming to that space is that eventually you will take the ashram in your heart. And then wherever you go, you live by those principles so that you have a more fuller life. So that's the larger vision of the ashram.
And you're actively involved in the dance aspect at the ashram, or just in various aspects of it?
Everything. So there is no categorization. It's, you know, because an ashram is also a space of community work and communities coming together and working. So we do everything. So I do everything. So I'm involved. If there is a need with the dance part, I'll do that. Whether it's a need with infrastructure, I'll do that. Whether it's admin, I would do that. So there is no certain, it's not a very structured, institutionalized role framework. It is a framework with an intention of giving, with the intention of doing seva. So you just serve in whichever way towards the development of the space and towards the development and the spreading of the work, which is the key.
Wow, that's really beautiful. So a service and just being present to everything around you.
I'm sorry?
I said, so service is a big pillar and being present to everything that is around you that allows that journey to take place and to shape the ashram as it is.
And service and selfless giving, you know, because the ashram doesn't belong to anyone. The ashram belongs to a community. And this the space is a community space, and it is for the community. I am, as a worker, as someone who's just actually, I have the opportunity to serve in that space. And that's the approach through which one works in a space like that, because it's not about ownership at all. Because I don't own that space, you know. The space is for, it's a public space. I am just a medium, and I'm working towards making and formulating the space. And not only, like, my teacher has been working for the last 20 years, and I have been working with her since the last 13 years in the space. So yeah, serving, it's more about giving service.
That's beautiful. Is there anything else that you would like to share about your journey with design and dance and where you feel you're at in your life right now?
Well, I would just maybe just like to say that, you know, it is that I'm just a mere traveler, you know, and it's just like, you know, sometimes the introductions and these talks that sound really like, you know, I feel a little embarrassed and a little concerned, you know, because I'm a traveler, and I've just been fortunate to find a medium that I really love that becomes my work, and I spend my life that way. But, you know, these large terms like transcendence and things like that. But, yeah, I'm just a traveler, and I'm also trying to understand. I'm trying to live things, and I do fall, and I do pick myself up. Sometimes I can't. So it's just a very human engagement, whether it is with the dance as a form of transcendence, or whether it is with the practice of holistic design, or whether it is working in the ashram space or for the ashram space. It's just a way in which I find my inner space and my inner self, and I'm traveling. Yeah, that's all I would like to say.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing your journey, because I think so many of us can benefit from it. And I know I myself have just been amazed at what tenacity and strength you've had to stay committed and to walk the path that you have, because I know it's not always easy. I'm sure you yourself have had some obstacles, and were there times that you questioned, am I doing the right thing, or is this where I should be?
No, I never questioned whether I'm doing the right thing. I always was way too strong, headstrong, that I know I'm doing the right thing. Though it is difficult, because the moment you walk away from the tide, that's what the other society force is what comes your way. So right. One fights it, and so I never questioned whether I was doing the right thing at all. I was always very sure, and I think because of being so sure all throughout, I was able to just stick to it with a lot of intensity. And, you know, but yeah, it requires, I think, some sense of conviction. First, clarity that, you know, the clarity that, yeah, this is what I want to do. When there is complete clarity, I feel you'll get the conviction that, no, I need to walk this way. And I think when that conviction comes, courage comes with it. And I think courage does it all, you know. So then, yeah, there are obstacles, there are things that, you know, it's not been easy. It's never easy, I think, for anyone who chooses to do anything that is very dear to them, because the moment you do that, the focus becomes inner growth, and somewhere the outward society is very sensitive to inner growth, and they resist it again and again. So I think each one has to then fight their own and fight to get what they really are walking towards. Yeah, so yeah, not easy.
Yeah, no, totally. I myself have kind of been trying to figure out that path and journey, so I completely understand. Do you, how pivotal were your parents in? Because I know you mentioned that you were very young when a lot of this started happening on your journey. were your parents and their support a really, really big help along the process, as you mentioned? Because sometimes there's a pull from society and family to say, oh, no, you should do this or be this, or the expectations that come with that.
Well, to be very honest, I think it's been as difficult for my parents as for me in different ways, because it gave them a lot, like they found it very difficult to kind of process what I was going through and, you know, why these changes. And so, yeah, it's been, but they stuck by. There have been times where they did not understand, which is, I think, very valid. And I think that somewhere they have struggled more than I have, because I had my the love for what I really wanted to do that held me on. They did not understand that, but they stuck by me. But yeah, it's been difficult. And so I think they have gone through a lot of pain in the process, because they did not understand at certain points, which is also extremely understandable that they did not understand. But yeah, they've stuck on, and I'm extremely thankful and grateful that, you know, they've, you know, I'm quite a difficult person, I think, to be with at times, you know, because of just a rigor of, a fierce rigor of, you know, following what one wants to do. So I think it's been very difficult for them, but I think they've really stuck on, and I'm very, very thankful and, you know, grateful to them for everything. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I mean, I can't say enough about your journey. I mean, it's just very powerful. And like you say you're headstrong, and that's, you know, you're committed, and it's so beautiful to see that, because I feel like there's a place inside of you that you just knew this is where you were meant to be, and you were able to follow that voice. And although I know you said you weren't aware of that at such a young age, I feel like it was an inner calling of yours to come back to dance and to be able to share that with the community and give back in the way that you have with the Shakti Yoga Ashram. It's kind of like this full circle of your journey, you know, like starting, finding the path, and then working toward that for so many years, and then now being able to give back what you had learned and what you're learning, and sharing that, and allowing the communities and the people around you to be a part of that transformation, and give them the tools to also have their own sense of transformation. And I think it's really at the heart of what I feel like, for me, Indian classical dance and dance in general kind of brings, is this like sense of unity and being able to connect with people around you in a very subtle but powerful way. And as you mentioned, as the dancer, or the person performing the art, it's all about intention and what we bring that ultimately unlocks and potentially can tap into other people's inner consciousness and awaken and uplift. So I really appreciate you sharing the journey with us and really being honest and candid about everything. And I'm not sure if there's, Bobby, do we open it up for Q&A now?
I'm gonna jump in here, and I can't believe how fast this first hour has gone.
I know.
It was amazing to hear both of you in conversation. Yes, we are going to open up a little bit. So anyone has a question can either hit star 6 or write in at ask@servicebase.org. I wanted to share a reflection from Meethi that came in from our invitation to this call from a woman named Anissa. And it's a beautiful reflection and really relates to the conversation. And she says, I began studying dance at 3 years old and was trained as a professional ballerina for 15 years. The grace and beauty of ballet called me to step out of the idea of who I am into a discovery of what I am not. Many would not understand this, but as I danced professionally, traveling and teaching for 20 years, dance brought me to an altar of reflection, like a divine mirror where I could recognize myself without seeing a form. And now, as my body deteriorates, it is called to be still in this reflection of grace. I dance, but for no one. I dance, but as no one. I dance as the immovable self. I look forward to hearing Mithi sharing because it sounds like she has also been shown her truest grace through the grace of dance and music. In discovering her story, I am encouraged and inspired to share in her story.
That's lovely. That's lovely.
I thought it was just, you know, really that those words, I think, are, you know, vocabulary is always such a tricky thing. We talk about the form and the formless. Mithi, you know, talk about getting a little bit embarrassed by the use of the words, like, you know, moving towards the transcendent. And but, you know, there is something there. I think what you talked about earlier, I think you mentioned in the training with your teacher, you know, this the intensity of that process and the invitation really to have a parallel spiritual process alongside the discipline of the dance. And I, you know, I can't help but think of some of these, you know, these classic teacher-student movie moments, like Mr. Miyagi and the Karate Kid, and like this, you know, this intense training where your mind isn't able to fully comprehend what you're being asked to do, and that's part of the point. Because the mind has to drop away. And I was wondering if you have any stories from that time, you know, as you were beginning to work with your teacher, of what that process, and maybe stories that kind of illustrate for some of us who don't have a dance practice, what that, like, how that journey of stepping away from or working on dissolving the ego kind of played out.
Well, you know, there, I can't think of anything particular, but it's just, it's all very kind of one into the other. So, you know, the training is not that, you know, today you learn about the form, now tomorrow spiritual. No, it's more in conversation. It is more in understanding when a movement is taught, and it is about the movement goes from left to right and it curves like this and it's demonstrated. But when you are doing it, the approach through which you do it, what you are thinking, is all kind of in conversation, in movement. It just comes together, you know. So I'm sorry, but I don't know if I can really even verbalize this, you know, in a certain way. But yes, there is importance to fitness, because the respect to the body, there is importance to what you eat, what you don't eat. There is, so food, fitness, there is also meditation, you know. And so that is the parallel spiritual practice, where stillness, because dance is eventually all about stillness, you know, in movement, in motion. And so there is a quality, like they say that, you know, when a dancer dances, she's compared to a sculpture, that, you know, she was as still as a sculpture. Mm-hmm. And in an architectural, you'll see that the space is moving. So there's always a parallel quality of an allied art, which becomes the strength of that form. So thus in dance, it is all about stillness. And, you know, so there is a spiritual base of, you know, meditating and, you know, practicing that along with the practice of the dance that is taught, and that is reinforced again and again, that, you know, only the mere practice of the form is not important. The understanding of the philosophy, the gods, the goddesses, because that's the content. If you don't believe in the content, then how are you going to be true to the content and thus to the dance? So it's all kind of one into the other that just work towards it. And then, of course, the ego really drops, because, you know, these are very demanding disciplines and your body just gives up at points, you know. So there have been times in training then when you just don't get movements, you just don't get moods, you just don't get an understanding. Mm-hmm. And it's all about discipline in the end, you know. And somewhere the ego resists discipline of all kinds. That's human ego, that we don't like a certain discipline. But, you know, these forms travel through intense discipline, you know, to take you to a stage of a certain equilibrium. And then the discipline, then you can break the grid, you know. It's like you learn to travel in the grid, in a framework, and then when you have mastered it, you have the liberty to break it. So, yeah, it requires just doing and, you know, just letting the ego be and letting the questions means a certain kind of aggressive questioning be, you know, that no, you, the elbow needs to be there, it needs to be there. But of course, there is a science behind, because when the elbow is in a certain position, a certain body circuit is being formed, which is, you know, connecting dots inside. So that is why the elbow needs to be there. So I cannot demand that I don't like the elbow there, I'll put it here. No, the elbow goes there, you know. So it works on the ego also, you know, because then you can't decide everything.
And I think when you're sharing that, I think what's coming to mind is how we are so maybe unconsciously in the mainstream paradigm conditioned to use our willpower, I guess. And and what you were saying is, like, you can't use your mind to execute, you know, in this way. It's almost like you have to embrace surrender. And but a disciplined surrender, it's not like it's just like, oh, take it as it comes, or do whatever feels like, do whatever you feel like doing. How does that play in? Like, what does that word surrender mean for you? Like, how do you understand that in your own practice?
For me, it is love. I think when you love, then you will, then everything melts. The ego melts, and what results in is surrender. So also it is, you love first the subject that you are practicing. Second is then you love the medium through which it is coming to you. So the teacher, the connection with the teacher is very important, because it is almost a certain kind of transmission that happens, you know, where you also start looking like your teacher for some time. Because there's so much energy that has been given, because it's a performing art, you know. I cannot see a video and learn it. I need a living energy. Like, you know, as many as tutorials and videos and all are put up, if you want to really understand the dance, you'll never be able to without a living energy. So it is about loving first the subject and loving the goal behind it. So what is the purpose of this training? What is the purpose? So the purpose for me somewhere in my life is to find a higher self, or find an inner self, something that is, you know, something more than the mundane. And the medium that I have found is through the dance. So first the love for the goal, then the love for the form, the dance form and its philosophy and content. But that is also not enough. And then finally the love for the teacher. Like, if you love the teacher immensely, then you'll receive what is really being given to him. By loving doesn't mean cushy love, but it is real love, where you give yourself in service, where you do things for the teacher, where you really let your ego go and listen, you know, to things that are being told to you, where you're sometimes not very happy with what you're being told because you're pulled up. But, you know, trust, you know, so when you love, you'll trust. And when you trust, then you receive, and then that I feel is surrender. You know, then you surrender to the form, to the teacher, to everything that is going into taking me to that inner space. And the teacher is extremely important, because if that link was not there, then it is impossible for the dots to connect. And that is grace, you know, that you find a teacher who's also ready to, who gives you in abundance.
Yeah, it's so energizing to hear that. And in a way, I think that the approach that you're talking about, and it goes beyond just dance to any field. Like, these principles can be applied. Yeah, and I was thinking that, and that said, each form has its own, is a unique doorway. And you know, they're not necessarily, and that there's a beauty in that variety of doorways that we have. And when you look at dance, I feel like, you know, and I've never thought necessarily of it before until listening to some of your conversations and hearing you speak of how dance in a way is a unique intersection that works at so many different levels, because there's music involved, you know, there's a visual element involved, there's movement involved. Can you speak a little bit about the way dance works? Yeah,
so dance is basically multidimensional, and that's why sometimes it's also classical Indian dance, and it's sometimes more difficult to even understand it. Like if you compare it to music, sometimes music is easier and instrumental music is easier than vocal music, you know. So dance at once, it has poetry, which is classical. The poetry is either in a regional language or in Sanskrit, and the poetry has by in itself is a classical poetry, which means it has a philosophical multi-layered meaning and context that is layered to classical music. It is not even layered to linear music. It is layered to classical music, which in itself has its own science, you know. So that poetry layered into music, then put in a framework of movement, and movement in classical Indian dance has two aspects. There is pure dance, which is pure movement, which is geometric movement based on the style. So Mohiniyattam, as I said, has swinging, swaying, circling movements. Bharatanatyam has triangular and more angular movements. Mohiniyattam is softer. Bharatanatyam is a little more dynamic and diagonal. So there is a certain geometry, but that movement also has a science. Like there is the core, which is the navel, the center of the body from where all movements rise. And it's a whole yogic experience and a yogic design formation that when these forms were visualized at the physical level, they were designed so that somewhere all the circuits of the body connect. So when you dance, you will feel energized. So basically there is pure dance. When there is movement which represents pure joy. So classical Indian dance has pure dance, and the purpose of it is just beauty and joy. And then there is expressional dance, which is, or representational dance, which is abhinaya, which is storytelling. And the storytelling, when that comes in, it layers itself with the myths and the gods and the goddesses and the philosophy and the principles that they stand for. So at once there is poetry, there is music, and there is movement. And in movement, there is pure movement, which is just a pure energy circuit and energizing your body and thus the space and thus the audience. And along with that, some dances are layered with storytelling. So I might be dancing Shiva, Ganapati, I might be dancing, you know, Krishna, but Shiva, Ganapati and Krishna by themselves are forms that need to be pierced into and understand the essence of what they are. So it's a very intensely compact engagement, I would say. And so when it really gives you, if you understood it or somewhere you, if you learn how to experience it, it will give you much more in abundance than any other form because of its a multi-dimensional framework. And it's also difficult to comprehend, you know, sometimes. So you need to learn the language of understanding classical Indian dance.
Yeah, and as you're speaking, I feel like it also, it forces your mind to become comfortable with the vastness of what it doesn't know, or to just hold it, because it seems like there's no, it's not like you can ever finish this study.
No, you can never finish. It's a lifelong journey, and one is learning, and one is trying to pull oneself up again and again, because again it's a body discipline, and which requires a constant practice. So it requires to be at it all the time. So that is that at the level of the body, but at the level of the philosophy, content, context, there is never enough that you have studied, you know. So you'll do this and all this, but this is not done and that is not done. And now you need, so you can go deeper and deeper and deeper as much as you want. And they say lifetimes are also not enough. So.
One of the questions that comes up for me, given how ancient these forms are and all the different dimensions that you mentioned, whether it's the poetry, the mythology, the actual dance form itself, the music behind it. These are such ancient forms that have been, you know, kind of passed on down the centuries. In that sense, does it feel like because it doesn't sound like when you're speaking, it sounds like it is a very dynamic, evolving form and not something that's kind of set in stone or static and just meant to be rigidly, you know, passed on. What is that intersection between the preserving the certain the purity of the form and yet also having it be a living thing?
So these are living traditions, and they are passed from one generation to the other. And so that's why when you train in any classical art, the most important thing is teaching, because it is almost like a responsibility that everything that I have received, I need to empty it out in at least one human body before, because then the tradition will go on. And that is why teaching is extremely integral to all classical arts, Indian arts. And it's always a teacher-taught relationship. So when if I meet someone and if I tell them, you know, that, oh, I'm a Mohiniyattam dancer, they'll immediately ask me, so who is the teacher? You know, so you are almost, your identity comes from the tradition that you come from. So the teacher taught is extremely important. It is impossible to preserve these performing arts without a living tradition. Like, they cannot go, even if they go into books. As I said, that if I might have the most interesting workbook and drawings of the dance and the steppings, but it is of no use to me till I have a living energy who deconstructs it and transmits it into my body. So so the traditions have lived over the years, and, you know, fortunately, somewhere in the classical dance, it's unbroken, it's there. There are lots of dancers and lots of teachers in that sense, you know, who are still practicing it and still teaching it. And though, of course, the avenues of performance, the sociological structure is not supporting it. The tradition continues. The tradition continues. And yeah, the teacher is extremely important. And, you know, archiving is not a part of the Indian tradition at all. So if you see that, you know, nothing is really archived very well in India because they never believed in it. They believed in human to human connection and giving it to the student. You know, so whether it was spirituality, whether it is the arts, whatever it is given to the student, you know. Then the student is the book and the student is a living archive. So now, of course, archiving is happening and, you know, parallel things are happening, which is good also in a certain way because of technology. You can take benefit of that. But it is still important that it is somewhere given, like it enters another human being. Then you are safe. But then it's a responsibility that one has to give it back in all its purity to another human being. And for that, you also, yeah, it's just work. And one just feels that that is the most important thing, you know, that to be able to teach it all to someone else.
And there's an incredible generosity, I think, in that view and that approach, that you don't want to have anything, any blessing end with you, that it, you have to be part of a chain. And that pay it forward approach is so it's so beautiful that that's embedded into the tradition. Go ahead.
Yeah, Jenny.
I was wondering, just because you know, Mohiniyattam and the mythologies and the stories and the tradition that it comes from is so rich, and for most of our listeners probably completely unfamiliar. I was wondering if you could maybe share one of the, you know, in your experience, either, I mean, I'm imagining like countless dances that you've done and mythologies that you've danced. Is there a particular dance or, you know, a symbol that you have developed a particularly deep relationship with in the course of your dancing? Could you maybe share a little bit about that symbol and what it means?
Yeah, sure. So lots, actually. So, you know, somewhere through this, I have understood, you know, what the gods and goddesses and somewhere what the rituals really mean. So I can probably take the most simplest example of the elephant-headed god, you know, which is Ganapati, which is the god in the Indian pantheon. And there are, every dance recital normally begins with a dance in praise of Ganapati, just as every Indian ritual or Hindu ritual or puja begins with Ganapati because he is a remover of obstacles. But, you know, through the practice of this dance and the understanding of the symbolism somewhere, you know, the essence of what really Ganapati means and what these rituals really mean, you know. So So Ganapati, so as my teacher has taught it, you know, that Ganapati is not just an elephant-headed god. Why is he the one who is a remover of obstacles? Why is he the one who is, you know, prayed for, prayed just in the very beginning of everything? So there are every aspect of his body is almost deconstructed, that, you know, the fact that it's an elephant head, the elephant as an animal is, first of all, the strongest animal who's completely vegetarian, completely positive, and has a great memory. So Ganapati is actually a symbol of all these, that, you know, you can... So Ganapati, an elephant, is actually completely environmentally friendly and ecological and yet strong, you know. So that's the essence from where it really comes, and it's complete non-violence, you know, and positivity. Then simple things like, you know, the ears of the Ganapati are like, you know, the vinos where you can put the grain in and remove the shaft and means remove the main grain and the shaft. And so that is like, you know, the ears of the Ganapati stand for that, that you listen to everything but take what is good and leave the bad out. And then, you know, symbols like he rides the mouse, and the mouse is his vahana. Like every Indian god has a animal that they ride or they are associated with, and the Ganapati is the mouse. So what is really the mouse standing for, and why does Ganapati ride the mouse? And the whole meaning is that the like what in our body is really like the mouse. It is our mind. And, you know, the mind can go anywhere. Right now we can be talking, but our mind can go somewhere else and come back. And Ganapati is the master of the mouth. So be the master of your mind and don't let the mind control you. So these are just, you know, simple logical symbols that then somewhere enter your life. And if you want that abundance, if you want that positivity, his belly is, the big belly is actually supposed to be a belly full of creative energy and positivity, and that's why it's always big, you know. So if you want that, then you connect to that force. So that's how, you know, so somewhere through the dance, you first of all understand these intricacies. And when you understand these symbols and these principles, that yes, you know, that's how I need to, that's how I can listen, or that's how I can live, or that's how I can engage with my mind, then somewhere Ganapati is entering my life. And then it becomes real to me. And if I want those qualities to enter me, then I will pray to Ganapati, because Ganapati stands for that, you know. So praying to a Ganapati is not just because you're told that now come on, pray to Ganapati. It should not be that way. Somewhere you need to understand, you need to really connect, and you need to really feel for that form. And eventually it is just a form. It's the same principle of the formless to the form, and the form taking back into the formless. There is a formless energy. It is manifested through the form of Ganapati. I connect with the form and travel through it and enter into the realm of the essence of what Ganapati stands for. That is what these rituals are all also meant for. Like when we do these pujas and all, they are exactly like the dance. That you trap, and we need forms, you know. We are humans with senses of touch and taste and sight. It is very difficult for at least majority of individuals to engage with a formless jnana marga. And the purpose of life in Indian thought is always moksha, liberation, transcendence, whatever you want to call it. And to support that, these art forms as ladders have been created, and thus are the pujas and thus are the rituals that we travel through. So through the dance, I have understood these things. Through the dance, I have experienced the essence of just trying to assimilate the principles that Lord Ganesh stands for in my life, you know. And in the same way, every god is somewhere deconstructed like this as you travel through and as you dance. And, you know, if you dance with understanding, then somewhere it gets deconstructed and you experience it in a different way. So, you know, for someone who feels that, oh, I don't believe in Ganapati, maybe they'll start believing in that energy of that Ganapati. And then when you believe in that energy, you'll connect with the form. And the forms are meant only for that, so that you connect with that energy back. So, yeah.
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful one. One question, there's so many different directions we could go in, but I want to just zoom out a little bit and ask you, in your life, in the work that you've done, in the internal journey, in the external discipline of dance, and other work that you've done,
with Miti Design Lab. What if someone were to ask you, because in a way, you know, whether we realize it or not, we are all designers, right? We're all designing our life.
Yeah.
Whether we're good at it or bad at it, conscious of it or unconscious of it, design is a principle, it's there. And I wonder, you know, from your experience, what do you consider to be when you think about like good design or, you know, design that is manifesting its potential, like what do you think about when you think about what is good design?
Well, when I think of good design, I think of nature, which is you know, all ingrained within multi layers, that which is beautiful, that which is harmless, that which is, you know, functional, that which is giving, that which is sharing, and yet without any expectation. So there is a tree which will flower, which will give you fruit, but the tree has no expectations, you know. So basically a good design, I don't know in which sense, like I can talk about it in a very pragmatic sense, and I can say a good design is that which is functional, that which is aesthetic, and that which doesn't harm society is a good design. But that is an outward manifestation of design. But an inward manifestation of design is almost like a space that you experience of beauty, of stillness, of no negativity, you know, of any kind. And that, I feel, is a state of consciousness, which is the highest essence of design, you know. Can you reach that framework? And nature has it, you know. Again and again, you see there is no competition in nature. There is no aggression in nature. There is stillness in nature. It's giving. So inspiration comes, and also aesthetics. So much beauty in nature. So if you look at it at a spiritual level, it's different. But if you look at it from a pragmatic level, I would say design, which is at once beautiful, means looks, it is aesthetically powerful, at once which has meaning, which has function, and at once that which doesn't hinder with the equilibrium of nature in any sense through the material is sustainable. You know, that is a good design. And yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful answer, and such a reminder, because that's something we all have access to drawing inspiration from. Krishna, I'm going to hand over to you for our final question and closing. This has been such a rich call.
Yeah, so those are all great questions, Bubby. So much information, so much great insight, Miti. So I just wanted to close with a final question that we ask each of our guests. Miti, how can we as the larger service-based community support your work and what you're doing?
Oh, well, I think the fact that, first of all, you all have invited me for this call is a great support, because somewhere, you know, sharing the work of the ashram is actually more important to me than anything else. And that's something that, because we are looking for more people to experience what we have to offer, we are looking at spreading the work, we are looking at more people understanding this holistic engagement with life, so that lives become simpler, lives become beautiful, lives become more meaningful. So I am, first of all, extremely thankful to Awaken Calls, to the service-based community, to all the volunteers for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to share my journey, though I feel a little embarrassed, and I don't think it is any profound journey. It is just something that has revealed, and well, it happens to be through me. But I feel that somewhere, if the Shakti Yoga Ashram work can, you know, if I don't know if that adds any meaning to your community, to the community that is being engaged, then we'd be more than happy to host more people at the ashram in our residential retreat. And they happen at any time in the year. You can get in touch with us, with a group of people, and we will curate a retreat for you in the given time that you want. So that's a support for the work at the ashram would be a great support. But
Is there a website or where can people get this information if they're interested?
Yes. So there is a website which is called shaktiyogaashrama.com, which has most of the information. We are actually in the process of redesigning it. So the new website will be up in a month's time, but the existing website also has the information about our programs. And you can write to us, like if someone is traveling to India with a group of people and they would like to be a part of a retreat, you can write to us with your dates, you write to us with, you know, your backgrounds, and we'll curate a retreat for you within the larger vision that we have. And we would be very, very happy to host you and give you what we have and what that space has to offer.
Oh, that's great. So make it more accessible to everyone to go on this journey and be a part of it. I think that's beautiful. And yeah, in any way that we can support your work, we are more than willing to do that.
Thank you very much. It is so, it's just, you know, very touching that, you know, here is a community, you know, which is just out of love and generosity and sharing, you know, doing these calls, running the space. And, you know, it's just extremely touching that, you know, and work happens at multiple layers, at multiple avenues, and all need to continue for the larger work to happen. So as far as I'm concerned, I almost feel that it's one community that we belong to. And we are just working in different locations towards the similar larger goal. So I'm very, very thankful for being a part of the community and sharing. And I would be more than happy to do anything that you would feel that I can, you know, give. Just ask me and I will do the needful. So please feel free to let me know. Yes.
Thank you so much, Neeti, the generosity and just the, you know, the, I think what you said earlier really hits on it, that anyone who follows a path of love, and that's what you've been doing, you know, the deep love that you have for your dance, for the teacher, for the principles behind it, make your journey such a gift. And I know you're very humble about it in terms of not necessarily feeling like you deserve, you know, the spotlight on you at all, but you definitely have so much to offer. And by virtue of being so engaged with what you love, you kindle that possibility, I think, in all of us who are listening, and reconnect us, you know, with our own journeys and our own love in this world. And that is a beautiful gift to offer. We will definitely send out more information about, you know, the resources that you mentioned to our listeners, and it will also go up on the website for people to access down the line. We will close this call, as we close all our calls, with a minute of gratitude for what we have received here, and in, you know, an offering to share that with, to beam that out to other corners of the world. We'll close with a minute of silence. And after that, I will unmute all our callers and we will have a moment of collective gratitude for Neeti. So a moment of silence. On the count of three, we will all say a collective thank you to Neeti. One, two, three.
Thank you, Neeti.
Most welcome. Thank you so much to everyone who has been listening and a part of the conversation. Thank you very much.
Blessed
thank
be.
You.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.